Today's Teisho will be on case 47 in the Book of Serenity, Zhaozhou's Cypress Tree. Introduction: the cypress tree in the yard, the wind-blown flag on the pole, it's like one flower bespeaking a boundless spring, like one drop telling of the water of the ocean. The ancient Buddhas, born periodically, go far beyond the ordinary current, not falling into words and thought. How can you understand verbally? Case. A monk asked Zhaozhou, "What is the living meaning of Chan Buddhism?" Zhaozhou said, "The cypress tree in the courtyard." Verse. The bank eyebrows lined with snow, the river eyes contain autumn, the ocean mouth drums waves, the boat tongue rides the current. The ability to quell disorder, the strategy for great peace. Old Zhaozhou, stirring up monasteries, never yet stopping, uselessly expending effort, the cart is made to fit the groove. Originally without ability, it still fills the ravines and gullies. This is one of the most famous koans in the Zen tradition, the story of Zhaozhou, and the cypress tree in the courtyard. Some of you may have an idea of what a cypress tree is, and some of you might not. So let me just say that a cypress tree is an evergreen. The growth is usually very lush and thick, and cypress trees can become quite old and quite enormous. They're really not tall. They can be, you know, maybe 80 feet tall, but very thick and green, very beautiful green color. So a monk asks Zhaozhou, what's Zen all about? What's Zen all about? And he says, they must be sitting maybe in a room with a window, or they're sitting on the edge of the courtyard. And he says, the cypress tree in the courtyard. And that's the famous koan. So, I don't know if you, some of you are pretty young, and you don't maybe worry about, say, finances. But I am maybe 10 years away from retiring, and I have a retirement portfolio. In 2008, when the stock market crashed, my retirement portfolio was severely damaged by the crash. And by the way, that's my retirement, except for Social Security. Rutgers professors don't get a state pension, so what we put away in our portfolio is everything we have. You know, so. So in 2008, the market really crashed, and everybody I know, all my friends here, lost a lot of money. And of course, you probably didn't know notice if you're young, but if you have a retirement plan, you know, if you're thinking along those lines, the day before yesterday, the stock market plunged 500 points in one day, and it lost about 10% of its value, wiping out its entire gain for the year. So if you have $100 in the stock market and you're getting 6% per annum, you might have made 6%, but yesterday it was totally wiped out. And now you're back down to what you started with, And hopefully it won't get worse and you won't wind up with less. This is this can seem trivial, this kind of thing, but you know, if you're thinking about your future, you know, this kind of thing can be serious. You know, it can hurt. You know, a friend of mine said that her friend is like an engineer, and she has a portfolio, and she's out of work right now, and living off the interest of her portfolio. And so when the stock market crashed, it really hurt her. She's living on a certain percentage of what she's saved, and now that percentage is going down to zero. So, you know, these things have consequences, these kinds of events, and they can be a little bit unnerving. And then my next-door neighbors are losing their house. I might have mentioned this. John and Patrick were two really nice guys who moved into our neighborhood about 6 years ago. And John used to work in real estate in New York City. And he was making a huge amount of what I would call it an amazing amount of money. He was making $300,000 a year selling real estate in New York. And he and Patrick were paying something like $5,000 a month for an apartment in Manhattan. So they were living large, as they say. And then they decided that they wanted to come out and live in New Jersey, so they moved into our neighborhood and bought the house next to us in 2007, just before the stock market and real estate market crashed. And so they paid the top dollar for this house, and then they moved in. And then, of course, the real estate market collapsed. And during this period, I would get up in the morning and sit, and then I would go into the backyard and just stretch and look at the world, which is something I really like to do. And I looked over across the backyard. There's no fence between Patrick's house and our house. And I could see John sitting on the porch smoking cigarettes. And this was like as the sun is coming up. And he'd sit outside and just sit on the on his porch and smoke cigarettes. And sometimes it'd be very cold. And I think he was just very worried about what was happening to him. So anyway, you know, his real estate empire really just completely collapsed. He suddenly had this catastrophic decline in his income. And basically, he was making very little money. And suddenly, he couldn't pay his mortgage payment. So, he and Patrick are now going through, bankruptcy proceedings. They're going to lose foreclosure proceedings. And they're going to lose their house. They get to live there actually for a while. It takes quite a while to get your house foreclosed on. So they've stopped paying their mortgage, and they're just trying to save money for their next life, you know. But seeing my friends go through this really painful experience, John is 60 years old. So basically, he's 60 years old. He more or less lost his job, and he is losing his house. Now he has moved to Indonesia. He had a friend in Indonesia who sells real estate on the island of Bali. I'm happy to say that John went through hell, but he seems to be doing pretty well. He had developed over the years a drinking problem. This is so human, right? I mean, he smoked because he was stressed, making his huge income, and he developed quite a serious drinking problem. And during all of this, the financial collapse and everything, he really fell apart, I would say. And he's not the kind of person, I think, who would be interested in doing Zen. He knows I do that, and I didn't pitch it to him. But he did go through a 12-step program, and he stopped drinking. And he, you know, I think he was on antidepressants for a while, but he's actually off antidepressants. And he went to his friend in Australia, offered him this job selling condos in Bali, in the island of Indonesia. And John is really doing well. He's moved out there, and he is selling some real estate. He's not making a lot of money, but he's very happy. And by the way, he's become a Hindu. He's converted to Hinduism. When he was out there, he started going to Hindu ceremonies in Bali. And he decided to make a pilgrimage to all these sacred sites, these sacred temples on the island. And it came at the very right time for him. You know, it came at the perfect moment in his life, which was this moment of intense crisis, you know. And he said that going to these temples was very moving to him, and very powerful, very powerfully healing for him, you know. And so he actually took some time off, and he went on this pilgrimage. And he called me, and he said, "Kurt, I'm a Hindu." He said, "I thought you'd like that, you know." I said, "Yeah, that's very exciting." So I'm so happy that he's getting his life together. I saw this unfolding car wreck, you know. And he and Patrick are really nice guys. You know, I didn't see this, their lives. You know, as I watched this happen, I was so happy that I had my job, you know. It was like, wow, you know, that's really tough to be 60 and lose your shirt, as they say. And you know, in the old days, it wasn't like this, you know. 100 years ago, my grandparents on my mother's side were farmers. And during the Great Depression, we had this huge depression in the 1930s. You know, basically, my mother's family had zero cash. You know, like, they had no cash. But they didn't starve. You know, they had cows, and they had they had apple trees, and they had big garden. My grandmother used to put up vegetables. So, you know, even though my mother didn't have shoes in the summer, they all ate. They weren't afraid of you know, having nothing. They had a house, they had their farm. You know, people used to pay very minimal taxes on their property. So, you know, my grandfather was like an engineer on my father's side, and he lived in New Jersey. And it was terrible for him, right? Because nobody needed to hire an engineer, so my grandfather worked he fixed cars. And he worked in the Ford plant in Edison. But sometimes they weren't hiring, and my father and his sister really grew up like afraid all the time, because there was really nothing. You know, you could literally have nothing to eat and nowhere to live, you know. So you know, it's not quite that bad, but for John and Patrick, you know, they're thinking, you know, we're going to be out on the street. You know, what are we going to do? And so it was really frightening for them. And John, you know, really went through this real crisis. I mean, he said to me once, he said, he just was in despair. He said, you know, what can I do? You know, I've done everything I can. I've sent my resume all over New York. You know, and he said, I'm trying to make enough money to hold on to my house. He said, I can't do that. But something has turned around for him, you know. It's really a change in him. You know, I think that when I talk, I haven't met him since he went to Bali, but when I talked to him on the phone, he was so upbeat. He seemed so happy, you know, happy. And I don't think he knows much about Hinduism. I don't think John's not the kind of person, I think, who would read books on the history of religion. And I think he went to these temples and he went to these rituals and it just lifted him out of himself, you know. And I think this is really remarkable phenomenon, you know, that we can do this, that we have this power. And I actually think that Zen is very much about this way of dealing with a crisis or trouble, you know. I was recently reading this book. The title escapes me right now. And the name of the author also escapes me right now. But it was a really wonderful book. Kriti lent it to me. And it's by a therapist in a Tibetan tradition. And he was talking about what happens to people when they suffer some kind of a traumatic event or a painful, difficult event. And it was so correct. I just thought, that is so astute. It really impressed me. In fact, I think I talked about it a couple weeks ago. But he said, you know, when we suffer an injury, we contract. We contract. And I think that's so right, you know. It's like we contract. That metaphor is so accurate. You know, we sort of shrink down into ourselves. And it's like, you know, normally we're like a house with the windows open, you know, sometimes. And the door open, but when we're hurt or when we're frightened or attacked or something, we close up. You know, it's like we shut all the windows, pull the shutters, close the door, lock it, and we hunker down, right? You know, and when we're in that condition, then we begin to think about, we begin to become worried and fearful, and we begin to think in a certain way. You know, it's like you begin to think, what's going to become of me, you know, and you think, you try to think 10 steps ahead, you know, but, you know, when you think 10 steps ahead, it seems like you're blocked, you know, and then you think this way and you're blocked, and you think this way and you're blocked. And you can, you know, wake up in the middle of the night and you can just be thinking, you know, how am I going to pay for my house? You know, how am I going to pay these bills? You know, and it's like fear becomes a very dominant mood, you know, and you worry. You think, well, can I do this? What if this happens? Okay, so I'm still paying off the house, but, you know, what if I have a car problem? You know, and then you might worry. You might not have a car problem, but you worry about having a car problem. Or you know, you think, well, what if I get sick? You know, it might be in good health, but you begin to worry about. And this is so, I mean, I've certainly been in this place, you know, where you're just waiting for the next assault. You're just waiting for the next injury, you know, and you're very locked up and hunkered down and all the doors are closed. And it's like you're in an empty house. And the house is under siege, and you're sort of peeking out through the windows, you know, that mentality. And then your mind is just running riot, you know. It's just like all of these fears proliferate, and these projections, you know. You're thinking, what if this happens? What if this happens? And this is like the worst condition to be in, right? I mean, this is like this is samsara, you know. This is really samsara. And in that condition, it's very difficult to heal. You know, it's very difficult to open up, and because, you know, you're closed down, and you aren't even going to look out the window, right? Because it's just too frightening. And you know, all of us have it. I mean, all of us have been, I think, in that place to a lesser degree or a greater degree. You know. And people, when they're in that condition of mind, can be very aggressive or unpleasant, angry, spiteful, and also greedy, very greedy. I'll never forget years ago, I was at a sesshin at Daibosatsu Zendo, where Edo Roshi used to be the teacher before he was removed. And that's another story. But anyway, he was. I went there for some sesshin because he was a Dharma brother of my teacher, Genki Roshi. And I was. They get usually like 100 people for sesshin. They get a big sesshin, and they feed everybody on these long tables. You sit on these long tables, and the food comes down the table. And you know, I have to say two things. First of all, our cooking is so much better than their cooking. I mean, by a long shot. They don't know about the secrets of Indian cooking, and or Chinese cooking, or Japanese cooking. It's really just like, I think, terrible food. Okay. But, you know, I realize we eat this food solely for the purpose of keeping our bodies in good health. So that's good. Okay. Nevertheless, not very good cooking, in my opinion. And not very abundant, right? So these pots go down, and, you know, by the time they get to the end of the line, it's like, I hope there's something in that pot, because this is my only meal for the, you know, for the midday. And you know, and of course, everybody at the front of the line just heaps it into their bowls, right? It's very bad, actually. They heap it into their bowl, and then by the time it gets to the end, there's a little bit left for your bowl. And I noticed, I was at one sesshin, and there's this guy across from me, and like when the basket of bread would come down, he would take like four or five slices. He wouldn't take a slice. He'd take four or five slices and put them in his bowl. And I would see that, and you know, I thought, that is the strangest thing. You know, why doesn't, you know, but I think part of this is, you know, he was in that mindset, right? He's in that mindset. It's like, screw you all. You know, I've got to protect myself. I need this bread. You know, I need this bread. This is so human, right? It's like, you know, I need this bread. You know, it's like a, it's dog-eat-dog, you know, dog-eat-dog. So even though he's at a sesshin, et cetera, I think in that moment, he's, you know, especially around food, people can be very, food is sort of primal and elemental. And, you know, people, you know, piling food into their bowls, you know, it's also like an expression of fear or anxiety, you know. And it's just like that. You come. You've been sitting. You've been in maybe some pain. You're tired, and these elemental fears come out. This sort of habits. So this guy would take like four or five slices of bread, or he'd take giant portions, and I'd look, and there'd be hardly anything left in the bowl. And it made me mad, but I also realized, you know, he's acting from this very fearful place, you know. But we all get into this, you know, we all get into this mindset where, you know, I've got to survive, you know, and it's too bad for you, you know. This is the contracted state, the contracted state. And it's very common, you know. I think that in a society like ours, I think that this state is actually quite common, and even very rich people have this mentality, you know, where they feel very powerless, even though they're very wealthy and powerful, and even, you know, they feel hungry and not nourished, even though they have all this nourishment and all this money and power. They're still afraid. I think this is quite widespread. You know, even, I thought this was so interesting. This is even true, I think, for the president. Really, I mean, I'm going a little far from Zen. But I heard Obama, President Obama, speaking to a group of his supporters the other day. I heard it on NPR. And he said to his supporters, you have my, he said, a lot of people are criticizing me right now, but you guys have my back. You have my back. And I thought that was such an interesting thing for him to say, because actually, he's a very powerful man. He's president of the United States. And he's personally a very successful person. He graduated from Harvard Law School. He's worth about $20 million. He has, a beautiful family and, connections all over the world. And what he was really saying in this speech, I thought, was, protect me, please. So I thought, even the president doesn't feel safe. I mean, I really, you can say, well, as my wife says, you're over-interpreting, right? But I thought it was interesting that he didn't say, I've got your back. He didn't say, I'm the president and I've got your back. He said, you guys have my back, saying, please take care of me. See? And I'm not criticizing him, but I think he feels, that's coming out of a very fearful state, and that we've all been in. But I think a more confident person would have said, I have your back. I'm on the job. I'm protecting you. And what he really said was, please protect me. Even though he's the most, some people say most powerful man in the world. So this closed up state is really very human. And when you see people behaving really badly, it's because they're in this state, In the period of Nazi Germany, there were Jewish people who asked their friends for help, and their friends didn't help them. And their friends were not necessarily, anti-Semitic or anti-Jewish. They were just closed up. It was like, don't bother me. I have to survive, And there were some exceptional people, of course, who were able to be more open, right? So anyway, this closed-up state is a real problem, and we all get into it. And when we get into it, our fears proliferate like tendrils. They just go crazy. And it's very hard to get out of that state. I think that the Zen therapy, if you want to put it that way, is to restore a kind of trust in the world, and it's sort of trying to open the doors and the windows, When you sit on the cushion and you watch your breath, you eventually enter into this state, even if you just do it a little bit, where you feel calm and safe and protected. This is quite common, actually. People who are beginners, we'll practice for a couple weeks or even a month and a couple months, and one day they go, oh, wow, what was that? That was great. And this is that samadhi state where you begin to feel, empty and safe and connected, or just very, very safe, very protected, And when you enter this state, it can be quite blissful. It's like being held in your mother's arms or held in your father's arms. It's a very beautiful state. And if you continue to stay in that state, if you keep going back to that state, sooner or later you begin to encounter the world in a different way. you begin to encounter the world as like part of yourself, is how I would like to describe it. You know, so it's quite common, for example, to be at a sesshin, at a meditation retreat, and to hear the sound of, say, katydids or crickets or birds, and it just feels so intimate. It's like feeling your own head. You know, it's like scratching your own head or touching your own knee. It feels sometimes like these sounds are part of your own body, you know. And this is like the opening up of the human being, right? Where, you know, the balance, when we're in this contracted state, it's so difficult to get out. And it's because our trust in life has been undermined, right? Our trust has been undermined. Something has happened to us that has destroyed our trust. And this is really like the hell realm, right? You know, it's characterized by like the complete disillusionment in the world, right? All trust is gone. And I have to protect myself and swim in a bitter sea of danger, and so on and so on. And in that mentality, it just gets worse and worse. The more you produce fear, the more you tighten the lock. You know, you tighten close the windows tighter and tighter, and lock yourself in smaller and smaller rooms. And the Zen therapy, if you want to call it that, is to sit on the cushion and experience the fundamental emptiness of the self. You know, and when you sit on the cushion and you watch your breath, you begin to notice that your self-consciousness recedes. You know, and you realize that the self is like not always present. The small self is not always present. You know, it's here and then it's gone and it's back, and there's a kind of a continuum, but it's not a small self, it's just awareness, right? There's a kind of awareness continuum. There's a moment of awareness and there's a moment of awareness, and what we call the small self is not always present. But there's still this awareness, right, that goes on and on and on. And in this condition, you know, what we call the self becomes very open again, very porous. You know, emptiness is a way of describing its openness, you know, its porousness. And it's suddenly like you can breathe more freely, you know. When we're not terrified, and we're not in pain, that kind of pain, and we're not spinning out fantasies, but we're resting serenely in the moment, there's a kind of natural oneness to things, which is very beautiful, you know, really wonderful and deeply moving. Sandy gave me this book by this guy, Peter Hershock. And I've been reading it, and he uses this word intimacy to describe this experience. And I think that's so right. You know, when you're in deep samadhi and you encounter the world, it has this quality of intimacy. You know, for me, everybody's a little different, but I have this experience very powerfully in the morning when I wake up. And I am about to sit. I feel like the world is very intimate, it's like it's beckoning me, or it's waiting there for me, and I feel this great sense of like connection or trust, you know. And that's, I think, then I meditate, you know. And but that feeling of trust or connection is, it's like the world is just waiting for me there. It's right there. I don't know how to describe it other than to say, you know, this word intimacy is really right on. You know, it really describes it. And it's possible in that state to be very open and to be experiencing things moment by moment without any kind of a defensiveness, you know, without any kind of defensiveness. It's, this is very hard to preserve when you're off the cushion, you know, or things are going wrong in your life. But then we start contracting again. But, you know, on the cushion, under the right circumstances, it's possible to go from one moment to the next without any defensiveness. This is the ideal state of mind in Zen. You know, it's sometimes compared to like a great mirror. It's like the mind becomes this great mirror. And things are, we're witnessing things as they unfold, but without without fear arising, you know, without falling back into this locked-in, closed-up state. And we're watching it unfold like watching a movie, almost. You know, it's like watching a movie. Or it's like being on a great adventure. You know, like being on a great adventure. You know, there's a kind of a thrill to life when we're not in this closed up state. You know, I often think that actors must love their jobs because, you know, you get to be a hero. You know, you get to play the hero part. You get to play the villain part. And it's thrilling, right? It's, you know, it must be so cool, you know, to, you know, play Indiana Jones or something. You know, you get thrown off of a tank and you use your bullwhip and you catch the end of the tank and you drag yourself back up on the tank and you beat the Nazis up and throw them off the tank, or you're, you know, no matter what happens, you're able to surmount the situation. And you know, that's it must be a lot of fun to play that role, you know. And but even if you're a villain, it's a lot of fun, right? Even if you're the Nazi getting thrown off the tank, you know, you probably get thrown onto a mattress, you know, so it's okay. But it must be kind of fun, you know, because you're not so attached to what's happening. You know, you can enjoy the unfolding of the movie as a movie. But I think, you know, sometimes life can be like that, you know. If we're open, we can watch all of this happen with a kind of interested mind, you know, like a kind of engaged, compassionate awareness, you know. And we're not registering fear. And we're just watching everything unfold, and also acting in the world too. I mean, there's another dimension to this, which is, you know, when we're paralyzed by fear, when we're in that closed up state, we just want to be very still and not make any trouble, right? You know, it's just like, I'm just going to be very quiet and I'm going to stand here and I'm not going to do anything. But when we have more trust, when we're in this open state, this trusting state, it's possible to act with real spontaneity and real courage, you know. Because we're not, this element of trust is the most. I think if there were one word that Zen is really, really about, it's recovering this trust in life that we lose. By getting outside the small self and connecting with the world, you know. And when we sit on the cushion and we enter mushin, we enter emptiness, and then we begin to connect, it's like the circle around us gets bigger and bigger. And then it, you know, at some point we have the confidence to become, you know, to go out on the stage ourselves and to act. And it, you know, I don't know how to get to this exactly, but the key, I think, to acting is not worrying about the consequences, you know, but having trust in the process. Having trust in the process. And again, this is difficult, right? I mean, you know, normally when we act, you know, the worst way to act is to worry about the consequences, right? That's always like poison. Here's a trivial example, but it's still, you know, we have our washing machine and ironing board in the basement of our house. And before I go to work in the morning, I go downstairs and I iron a shirt and a pair of pants, and then I put them on. And downstairs in our basement, next to the behind the iron, there's a dart board with darts in it. And I turn the iron on, and it takes a minute to heat up, and I'll just toss darts at the target. And it's amazing, you know. I'll get them all, you know, I'll get a couple bullseyes, I'll get them in there, you know, it's just amazing. And I'm just killing time. I'm waiting for the iron, and I'm just lobbing these things over there, and it's like boink, 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 you know, and it's, they're all in the inner circle. Maybe a couple go out, right? But it's generally speaking, just like, that's astounding, you know, two bullseyes, you know. So the other night, Barbara was down in the basement, cleaning up the basement, and I said, let's play a game of darts, right? And I thought, oh, brother, you're going to be slaughtered, you know. And the first one didn't even hit the target, you know. And it was just, that was such a terrible score. She killed me, you know. And then let's play another game. So I lost four games in a row, you know. And I thought, how did that happen? But of course, you know, I was trying too hard, right? I wanted, you know, I wanted to reproduce what I had done just waiting for the iron to heat up. And I was trying too hard, you know. It might actually be helpful to think that all of this has been scripted in advance, and that we can't really control how it's all going to work out. But it's important to play, you know. It's important to act. That, I think, is a really good way to approach things. It's like, try but let go, you know, try but let go. And who knows, maybe it has all been scripted, you know what I mean? You know, maybe it's all, you know, the physicists say the universe is done. You know, actually, physicists say time is an illusion. It's all already done. And they actually say that. They say that really, you know, we're living in time, but it's like slices of a loaf of bread. The bread is already, you know, it's already a full loaf. We're just going from one slice to the next, but the loaf is already there. You know, and that could be very liberating, right? You know, knowing I'm just going to play the game, I can't control it, but I have trust in it, you know. That's like the ideal. That's Zen spontaneity, which takes for a long time, a lot of practice to develop. But it's like, I'm going to act, and I'm not going to worry about the consequences, because it's all already worked out. I'm just going to let it unfold naturally. I'm going to be part of the process, right? I'm going along for the ride, you know. I think if we're going along for the ride, it could be a happy ride, you know. We get nervous because it doesn't seem to be doing what we want it to, you know. The ride is not going where we want. But if we can just stay open, you know, we can really have a wonderful time. Sometimes when I meditate, I remember the past, and it's very powerfully moving, you know. So the other day I was meditating, and I was thinking about Seattle, being a young person in my 20s in Seattle, and how absolutely fantastic it was, you know. And this was all triggered by a conversation I had with my friend John Sunston. And he had gone to this Japanese store where my wife used to work, Shiga's Imports, and the store is still there. And I Googled it, and the picture, it looks like yesterday. It hasn't changed a bit. And I read the reviews by people who have gone to the store, and they said, this is the coolest store. You know, this is so wonderful. It's wall-to-wall Japanese tchotchkes, you know. So it is truly like a magical world, that store. And my wife used to work there, and so looking at the picture really was very evocative. And then when I meditated, all these memories came flooding back. And I realized, you know, if only I could do this again, but not be worried, you know? Because, you know, when I was going through this whole thing, I was worried. I was thinking, oh my God, will I get through graduate school? Oh my God, will I ever get a job? You know, I'll be, you know, so, you know, and I was training at the Zen Center because I was so worried, you know, which was a good thing. But if only I could just go back and say, oh, I know how it's all going to turn out, you know, so I might as well have a good time, you know. It would be great, right? It's too bad that I couldn't do that in my 20s, because now when I look back, it seems like a golden years, you know. I had it so good, you know, it was so wonderful. But when I was moving through it, I was worried a lot of the time. You know, I was thinking, oh, how is this going to end up, right? So, you know, it's not always possible not to worry, right? I mean, if we were Joshu, you know, we wouldn't worry. We wouldn't. You know, somebody like Joshu is very, 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 very accomplished. And by the way, being an accomplished Zen practitioner doesn't mean you can fly, you know. It doesn't mean you can walk through walls or something like that. Those would be trivial accomplishments, really. Don't you think? Years ago, Jaru invited me to talk to a class, and that was the first question. Somebody said, can Zen masters fly? Really? And the person said, somebody told me they can. And I said, yes, they can, but only when they're by themselves. And then I told them that was not true. But those would be trivial. Being able to fly would not solve any problems at all, right? Because you still have to come down to earth. And you still have to pay rent or, you know, mortgage. You know. So basically, what is more valuable than being able to fly or walk through walls is being able to be fearless, right? And I must confess, I am not fearless. But sometimes when I sit, and sometimes when I get off the cushion, it's possible to act fearlessly. Or with great trust, you know, great trust. So somebody like Joshu is a great accomplished master because apparently nothing shook his trust. He was going through the play and not worrying about its twists and turns, right? And this is also true for, of course, our great ancestor, Sengtsan, in the Shinshin Ming, you know, the verses, it's sometimes translated as faith in mind or the faith mind, but it should be trust in mind. So trust. And I say this, and I'm always amazed, you know, according to Zen tradition, Sengtsan was a leper, you know. He had leprosy, and there were no antibiotics at that time. So, you know, he had a terminal illness, and he was ill, and you know, his fingers would fall off, and things like that. And yet, he said, "The great way is not difficult for those who have no preferences. You know, when love and hate are both absent, everything becomes clear and undisguised. Make the smallest distinction, and heaven and earth are set infinitely apart. So he's saying, trust, 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 trust. And you could say, trust? Are you out of your mind? Look at you, you know. Where has trust gotten you? See, but that wasn't his mindset, right? He lived trust. And so, you know, we probably can't do anything in a certain sense, right? My second teacher, Glenn Webb, one of his teachers was a man named Shinichi Hisamatsu, who was a lay Zen master. And Hisamatsu was really quite a good Zen teacher. He used to say, what can you do when there's nothing you can do? What can you do when there's nothing you can do? So it's like you can't control anything. What are you going to do? And you know, Joshu's way was to enjoy the ride, you know. In the Nansen Kills the Cat koan, you know, Joshu acts spontaneously. He puts his shoe on his head and walks out the door. He's not worried about being right or wrong. He's just allowing the universe to unfold through his body. This is a challenge, right? I mean, easy to say, hard to do. But this is what Zen is all about. A great Zen master is somebody who has unshakable trust. This is not the same as self-confidence, right? Because I'm not sure I even believe in self-confidence. But I do believe in trust. You know, I think that it's possible to have this great trust in life. It's sort of indomitable trust. And to experience the world as like intimate. And that we have those moments on the cushion. You know, you get up and you're on the way to the bathroom and you hear the crickets and it's so intimate. You know, you're going to sleep at night and you feel the crisp sheets over your body and the pillow, and it's so intimate, right? And maybe you hear something out the window, a rush of cars going by, and it sounds so intimate. You know, it's like you know your body, your life. You know. So anyway, when Joshu, the monk says to Joshu, "What's Zen all about?" He's really saying, you know, how do we get? You know, what do we? What is Zen practice? What's it all about? And Joshu says, "Look." Look, you have to connect with what's out here. Zen is all about opening the circle. So when you're locked up in yourself, you can't, you're in samsara. You know, if you can experience the cypress tree as part of yourself, that's the road to delivery. That's the road to deliverance. That's the road to liberation, right? So Zen is about getting out of the small self and connecting to the larger world. And this process takes us out and out and out and out. So, you know, when you're feeling blue and you're feeling threatened and so on, you know, you need to do some zazen. And then, you know, you go out and you look at the trees and you feel more alive and you feel connected. And, you know, this is like a healthy state. You know, I'll wrap it up, but my second teacher practiced at Ura Senkei for many years. He's really like a true tea master. And tea ceremony is such a wonderful ceremony because, you know, it forces you to become one with things outside yourself. You know, if you're really focusing on making a bowl of tea, you have to focus on the whisk, you have to focus on the bowl, and you identify so strongly with these objects around you that you get outside the self. And when that happens, you begin to feel this tremendous sense of openness or relief from the internal pressure of being in the contracted state. You know, and at first maybe all you can do is focus on the tea whisk in front of you, and then you focus on the bowl intensely, and then you focus on the water in the bowl, and then you hand the bowl to somebody, and pretty soon you notice the screen or the vase in the alcove, and you notice the beautiful calligraphy on the wall, and then you notice you notice the sound of birds, and pretty soon you feel better. It's like each of these objects has taken you out of yourself and into the world, and by identifying with them, you begin to liberate yourself from your contracted state. This is the secret of tea ceremony, too. Zhaozhou's cypress tree. The cypress tree in the yard, the wind-blown flag on the pole, it's like one flower bespeaking a boundless spring, like one drop telling of the water of the ocean. The ancient Buddhas, born periodically, go far beyond the ordinary current. The circle widens, 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 not falling into words and thought. How can you understand verbally? A monk asked Zhaozhou, what's the meaning of Chan Buddhism? Zhaozhou said, become one with the cypress tree. Okay. When that happens, the whole world becomes your body. The verse is, the bank eyebrows lined with snow. So a bank of snow becomes like your eyebrows. The river eyes contain autumn. The river becomes like your eyes. The ocean mouth drums waves. The ocean becomes your mouth. The tongue boat rides the current. The boat becomes your tongue, see? The ability to quell disorder, the strategy for great peace. Old Joshu, stirring up the monasteries, never yet stopping, uselessly expending effort, still the card is made to fit the groove. It's like your life is like a railroad car on tracks. It's already going. So enjoy the ride. Originally without ability, still it fills the ravines and gullies.